The definition that we have of sex is so limited to intercourse that we think that when we're talking about sex, it's just intercourse we're talking about. There's touch, there's exploration, there's taste, all of that, like creating a proper feast for yourself. As a matter of fact, for some people, they've not had intercourse, they don't feel they've had sex. But in actual fact, you can go around your own sexual cycle from pleasure, desire to orgasm, and a penis hasn't even gone inside the vagina.
When it comes to sex, shame has had the mic for far too long, but Olawunmi Isan is rewriting that script. As a certified sex therapist and educator, she creates space for people of all identities to unlearn shame.
Yes, I was raped at 15 when thieves came to our house. And it was four of them that raped me, so they took turns. And so my dad took me to the hospital the next day. The doctor, they sedated me and did stuff. When I came around, the doctor said, don't tell anybody that you've been raped. You know, so basically they had stitched the hymen back. The fact that I wasn't allowed to speak was also trauma for me.
If a child experiences that, how do parents manage that?
Her work bends science, story, and soul, reminding us that sexuality isn't just physical. It's emotional, cultural, and deeply personal.
What are the most common intimacy issues you're seeing between couples today?
Desire discrepancy, when one person has a higher libido than the other person.
Is it a libido thing or is it more of trauma?
Whether she's in a session, on stage, or teaching to a packed room, Olawunmi brings clarity to the messy, courage to the quiet, and tenderness to the places we've been taught to hide.
I've seen a lot of men come in to say, I can't get it up with my wife, or I can't sustain it with my wife. When I go out and I'm able to, maybe I'm not attracted to my wife again. And here's the thing.
You know, you're one of the few certified sex therapists in Nigeria, and I have a lot of questions about about why and what. But I think the first question I have is, what drew you to this work?
I've always been interested in the field of sex, even as a younger person. Not so much the mechanics of it then, but I was very interested in, what was the science of it? What was the psychology of it? Why would people go crazy about it? Why would people take certain life decisions, you know, about that? And for the longest time, I thought I was going to be sex educating the African child. And I guess I still do that in a way with my kids. Because I went to a school where in secondary school, a couple of students got pregnant. One of them actually got pregnant and then carried the baby to full term. And this wasn't a story. This person was right in my hostel in a boarding school. And she carried the baby to full term. We did not know. We would see her every day, but she would bathe like very early in the morning, like 5 a.m. And she would always wear this cardigan. And she carried the baby to full term in school and gave birth to the baby in the bushes, dug a hole and buried the baby inside. And so it was the hunters around that found the baby and took the baby to school authorities. And so when you hear things like that, when you see things like that, I would wonder, why weren't parents talking to their kids about sex? Why did they have to navigate it alone? And as I grew, you know, in the field, I studied psychology and all of that. I then started to take a deeper interest in adult sexuality, not so much children. So adult sexuality, pleasure, a lot of my work is around pleasure, right? So pleasure, healing, and all of those things. And so that's how my journey started. And yeah, the rest is history.
Amazing. And you've said before that many people think sex therapy is about pleasure, which you actually just noted, but a lot of your work also deals with pain.
Yes.
And what are you really seeing this session? Are you seeing consistent themes? Is it so many different types of patterns, or does it all boil down to one thing?
So different patterns. We're dealing with people dealing with pain. We're dealing with people who have experienced trauma in their lives, dealing with people who are dealing with addictions. And then of course, people who want to improve in the bedroom, who want to enjoy more pleasure, whose sexuality has been so immersed in shame that they find it difficult to express even as adults. So a myriad of different things. And of course, with couples, things like desire discrepancy, where one person wants more sex than the other person, has a higher libido than the other person, and it's beginning to cause issues in the relationship. So quite a myriad of issues there. And then, of course, for the men, erectile issues, premature ejaculation issues and stuff like that. Yes. Mm.
And I'm curious, just going back to, you were saying you're interested in, you know, teaching children around sex. What age is appropriate for that? I know for me, in the U.S., I don't even know if they have this program, but there was literally a program called DARE. And this was in fifth grade, and they introduced, you know, sex. And I know many years after that program, it's been super controversial around when is the appropriate time to educate a child on sex. I believe, especially with Snapchat and TikTok and Instagram and YouTube and all these things, kids are going to find out about it anyways. So you might as well educate them, at least be the first person that they experience it with. Mm-hmm. Understanding what it means. Absolutely. But I'm curious, is there a specific age where a child can fully conceptualize sex?
Okay, so let me answer it this way. When we say sex educate your child, what we really mean is sexuality education. Sex is part of sexuality, but sexuality as a concept is much broader than just sex. And so when we say sexuality education, we're not saying teach your children about intercourse specifically, right? We're saying teach them about their sexuality. And when they get to the age where you have to talk to them about intercourse and all of that, we will get there. But we're saying sexuality education. And it should start as soon as you start to teach your child about their body. This is your hand. This is your face. This is your body. Because what we don't really understand is when we tell children, this is your hand, this is your leg, this is your face, and then we go there and then we say, this is your cookie. Or this is your whatever it is they call it, right? We are sending a message that there's something wrong with that part of our bodies. Why can you call your hand a hand? Why can you call your leg a leg, but you can't appropriately name your genitals? It has to be a cookie. It has to be a thing. It has to be a, I don't know, all of those names. It sends a message that there's something about this body part. And so sexuality education starts from there. And so you're telling your child, this is your vulva. This is your vagina, this is your penis, and you're educating them properly. So for my kids, we started as early as one, right? And so we would talk about those things, we would educate them, and then we started to talk about boundaries. And boundaries goes both ways. So it's not just about don't let anybody touch you in your private areas. It's also about don't touch anybody inappropriately as well, right? And so I would do this thing with my son, and I would simulate experiences. And then I would say, I would move close to him and see if I want to kiss him on the lip. And then I would move close to him. And then he would say, don't kiss me. You can shake my hand instead. So we would, even till date, he's 7 now, but we still do those things, right? Because we're trying to teach them, not just with words, but also with our actions, because we have to model these things to the children. So we have to teach them about their bodies, boundaries, safety, all of those things. And then as they get older, you can start to have conversations. Again, they're growing. It's a period of physical development, but also sexual development. So as a child also starts to grow, you start to understand that, we now have to start talking about periods. We have to talk about boundaries even more. If you hug somebody and they say, I'm not comfortable, or don't hug me, you need to understand that they are telling you that they're trying to enforce their boundaries, and you need to respect that, right? Whether you're a girl, whether you're a boy, it doesn't matter. And so you start talking to them about periods. And it doesn't matter if you're a girl or boy. Boys should also know that girls get periods. My son is 7, and he already knows that his sister gets her period. He understands what it is. I've explained it to him and all of this. He's advised so that he doesn't grow up and become one of those people who are like, yuck, period. You understand what I'm saying? So all of those things come into place. All of those things is part of sexuality education. I have a 10-year-old daughter, and we've spoken about sex as an intercourse now. We've spoken about those. We've had those conversations as well. I remember when she was 6, she went to the salon to make her hair. I wasn't there. And she came back home and she said, Mommy, I don't want to go to that salon again. I said, why? She said, because they show content that is inappropriate for children. She was 6. And so I had to call the salon. I said, my daughter said she's not coming back here. And they're like, what happened? She said, you show content that is inappropriate for children. So because of her, they had to regulate what they would project on the TV. So they said, okay, mornings to 6 p.m., please bring your children so that 6 p.m. above, we can play whatever it is that the adults prefer to see. So we said, okay, great. So we'll send the kids to come to the salon earlier in the day. But she was 6. Mm. I was not there. Mm. We will not always be there. And so when we say sex educate your child, we're talking about sexuality in totality, but it also is empowerment. Is it also says, I will not always be around you, but I'm teaching you so that you are empowered and you can make the right decisions even when I'm not there.
Okay. You know, this brings back some memories. I know the first time I tried to talk to my parents around anything sexual, I think I had overheard in school, maybe somebody say condom. So I came back and I asked my mom, please, what is a condom?
Wait, how old were you?
I can't remember. But I know all I remember was, where did you hear that from? And then, you know, your first reaction is like, I'm not going to snitch, number one. And she's like, where I said in school, the next day, marched all the way to school, called everybody out, teachers, everybody. And then that just makes you feel, you know what, these taboo subjects.
Absolutely.
Just keep it to yourself, right? And that's why, you know, we're going to transition into porn, right? Porn became how I understood education and learned about sexuality.
Most people,
yeah, right? Absolutely. Why do a lot of men, and even just people in general, but why do a lot of men turn to porn?
I think in a way you have answered it.
Yeah.
There's no safe space to express yourself or even your desires and your needs. That's why I tell people, I say, look, you have to understand that your sexuality is an integral part of our humanness, right? It's nothing to be afraid of. It's nothing to be ashamed of. But there's been so much shame around sex that when we think about sex, when we want to do anything in that light or address any sexual need, for a lot of people, it's shrouded in secrecy. And so because there's no safe space, there's no authority that tells you the right thing for a lot of men, since the question is around men, there's no authority that tells you the right thing to do, a lot of people then start to learn, get education from their friends. Whether we like it or not, we're always educating our children. We're always educating ourselves one way or the other. Just like you said, your parents called everybody out. What did you learn? You learned something. Yeah. This is not something we talk about. Yeah. It was education. It just wasn't the right one, right? And so people then go to spaces where they feel that, oh, I can get some education here because there's no place that I can get it. Mm. I can't get it from my parents. There's no resource that I can say is a safe space for me. So I'm going to learn it from my friends. And even when you don't intentionally set out to learn it from your friends, just will flow. And then people are like sharing stuff, putting stuff out there. And the sexual urge is so powerful that if it's not properly navigated, if you don't have self-control, it can, do you understand, just go out of hand. Yeah. And then people start to see these things that look interesting, right? And they're at that age where hormones are doing a number on you, right? And these things look good. You're watching it and your body's tingling and you're like, oh, I like this. You get a dopamine high and you want more.
Yes.
And if that is how you learned sex, for a lot of people, that is how they will continue to learn sex. And it's unfortunate. But allow me use that.
Yeah.
It is unfortunate because when people learn sex like that, it's not representative of what sex can look like in a marriage or a committed relationship. But you take those expectations because that is the learning you have. I always say every time, behind everybody, however anybody presents on the surface, there's history behind them, right? So I'm seated here today. However it is I present on the surface sexually, there's history behind them. I was talking to a client and she said, you know, when she was growing up, they told them that even looking at your body naked was taboo. It was sinful. You can't even talk about sex and all of those things. Then when she was getting married, it was all about the husband. And she's not the only one. A lot of people like that, right? And then it was always about you must have sex to please your man. Nobody ever spoke to her about pleasure. Mm-hmm. And so if someone like that comes to you and says, I don't enjoy sex, if you don't understand her background, you'd probably be saying, oh, why you should. And that's what a lot of people will say. So there's a lot of judgment. Oh, you should. And it's great. It's this, it's that. But people are struggling. And so imagine someone with that type of history. If she says that and is met with judgment, she will just close up. But if you understand where she's coming from, it makes sense that she doesn't like it. So if a man wants sex a certain way, thinks of sex a certain way, if you look at it on the surface or however it's presenting, you can be like, oh, you're asking too much or you're being unrealistic. But if you understand where he's coming from, how there was no safe space to learn, how he had to learn from his friends, how, you know, he started to enjoy watching porn, how that became education for him. If you understand that, it makes sense how he got there.
Man, you're triggering me.
That's why I'm just like
triggered. Because it's like, I feel like in my old age, I look back at that phase of my life, and you're right. Literally, as you described it, the friends you came up with, the conversations they would have, how they influenced how you looked at sex and the things you would then go on to do. So I want to go to, is porn addiction really the issue, or is it often a symptom of something deeper?
Well, it could be either. It could be the main issue, and it could also be a symptom of something else. For some people, it could be a coping mechanism. It could be a way of coping with stress. It could be a way of coping with mental health issues. It could be a way of coping with perhaps even lack of intimacy in a marriage. That's something that could happen as well, where you have maybe the wife is not giving sex. I don't like to say giving sex, but not having sex as much as the man wants. That can happen, where the man then resorts to other ways of satisfying that need. So sometimes it could be a symptom of a bigger issue, but sometimes, just like we said, it could be that somebody learned sex that way, and that was all they knew about sex, and that was basically their sex Bible. And so that became like, you get a dopamine high every time you watch that thing, and it's so good. I mean, and you know, this industry is very interesting because it's billions of dollars, right? And so they would always go higher, yeah, because they know that once you get to a point, your taste will evolve. You want more, right? It gets to a point where society, you know, gets to that level and you're like, oh, I've watched this, but I want more, yeah? And then they're always changing it, evolving all of the time. They understand the psychology of the
user. I tell her all the time, watching the data.
And exactly. And you keep watching and watching and watching. So it's just this rabbit hole that is designed intentionally to suck people in.
But actually, that's a question I want to understand, right? Because for the people who are watching this episode today, can you talk to, when you watch porn, like, what is literally happening in your brain? Like, what's, because I think people just throw out the word addiction, right? And I feel like people don't fundamentally understand, you know, is there, like, why are they getting addicted? Because you know, you talk about dopamine and all the other things. And is there actually like a measured approach? Like, can I watch a little bit of porn? Should I not even begin? Because, you know, in the Black community, on the other side is all these pastors. I don't know why it's always a pastor coming out and saying, I was addicted to porn and my life has changed. And now I'm helping you to, you know, stop watching porn. And so there's almost this conversation around, you shouldn't even engage in it at all. Right. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious first around what's happening in your brain. But number two, is there a limit that is actually safe?
Okay. So what happens when you watch porn? Of course, there's that release of dopamine, which is the feel good hormone, right? And whether it's porn you're watching, whether it's whatever addiction it is, whether it's porn, whether it's food, whatever it is, there's that rush, and it becomes a sort of reinforcer of that behavior. And the more you do it, the more you want to keep doing it, because it keeps you, the feeling that it produces in your body is a feeling that is good. Yes, you might deal with some shame afterwards, but in that moment, it feels really good. So it makes sense that people want to go back there, whether or not it's a coping mechanism, or whether it is something that people, you know, do as a pastime. It feels good, right? The sexual release feels really good too for a lot of people, for most people, right? And so that pleasure reinforces the behavior. Now, coming to what you had said about, you know, is there a limit to it? I have to say this. For a lot of people, the Black community, Africans, we're largely a very religious people, right? And that's why you say it's a pastor.
Yeah, it's always a pastor.
So we're largely a religious people. And in religion, faith, a lot of people believe that. So first of all, even without porn, people don't believe, a lot of people struggle with godliness and sexuality. Mm-hmm. Like, how can I be godly and praying and skabashing and saying, how can I be both things, right? There's that. And yeah. Then you now go to porn.
Yeah.
So for a lot of people, their faith does not support it. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of conflict there. Now you're having people being, I want to say, a bit more permissive. So when we say it's not about religion, it's about spirituality. You're having people now being more permissive with themselves to say, I can be a Christian and I can learn through porn. People say that, yeah? I've also seen people who are Christians and say, I'm okay with masturbation. That's another issue. But you see people who say, I'm a person of faith, masturbation is bad,
yep.
It's a sin, and all of that.
Yes.
But I've also seen people who say, I'm a person of faith, but masturbation is okay. Because people will justify these things in different ways. Some people would say, oh, well, it's better than fornicating if they're single. And then some people will say, well, even in the context of marriage, you know this thing in the Bible where Jesus says, if you don't even have to have sex with someone before committing adultery or fornication, just thinking about them, right? And then you see someone who's married and the person says, but if I'm already married to my spouse and I'm using their mental image to fornicate, am I committing a sin? Do you understand? So that's a bit of a workaround. Some people can come to terms with that. But you also see people who say, no, masturbation is a no-no for me, and that's what I feel. And the same thing applies to porn. You see people who have gotten to the point where they're saying to themselves, I can permit myself to watch it because I know that mentally in my mind, I'm just using it to learn, but I'm not getting addicted. It's not going to be something I'm watching every time. Yeah? And some people just want to stay clear of it. So my point is, people will make these decisions for themselves. And I cannot sit here and say a little bit of porn is good, a little bit of porn is this, a big bit of it. That's a very personal decision that people would make because some people are not comfortable with it. And I would not, you know, take a position to say, oh, a little bit of it is good. But if they're not comfortable, they're not comfortable with it. And some other people might say, oh, we are comfortable with it. We watch it together as a couple. We watch it maybe once a week and we're fine. Yeah. But one of the things I would say is you have to be very careful because you never know who has an addictive personality. Mm-hmm. You never know who is going behind, you know, to go and watch and go deeper and all of that, right? Do I think that there are resources that people can learn from outside of porn? Absolutely. Yeah. I also think that, you know, it's interesting that we don't talk about sex a lot in our society, but people are expected to get married and just figure it out and just know what to do without making room for that transition and learning and growing together, right? I think that people also need to be able to give themselves the grace to say, hey, we haven't learned this before. You're not going to jump in a car and start driving if you've not driven before. Yeah. Mm. Why do we expect ourselves to jump into sex and automatically know it if we don't know it?
Mm.
Or not just it alone, or if we don't know each other? Because there's this perception that if I've had sex with you and I've had sex with three other women or men, as the case may be, I know what obtains. So maybe all the women I've had sex with, all the men I've had sex with respond and enjoy sex the same way. And then I get married to somebody else and then the person doesn't respond to sex in the same way. I'm like, you must have a problem. So it's not even just about jumping into sex and expecting to know it, but also jumping into sex and knowing the person that you're with, because people can be very different in how they present sexually, in how they express sexually, in how they enjoy sex, and how they enjoy pleasure.
I love it. I think one of the questions a lot of the men definitely requested I ask you is, there's an issue where many men have maybe a lot of sex before marriage or before going into a serious relationship, right? And prior to that, again, going back to the education about sexuality, you're encouraged, you know, peer pressure, like have as much sex as possible, sleep with as many women as possible. So your body count gets out of whack. But what then happens is when you then get into a marriage or you get into a relationship, you might not have the same sexual hypersexuality that you had when you were single. Mm-hmm. And then it leads to complaints in your marriage or relationship, like, hey, you're not attracted to me, or maybe your wife or your spouse now or your girlfriend wants to be, you know, sexually liberated with you. And you're saying, fam, I was sexually liberated at 14. You should have caught the train. You know what I mean? It's like, what do you mean sexually liberated, right? So I think the question a lot of the men had is, how can they navigate that? Because what they start to feel like, which they voiced to me, is a lot of them now wish and realize that they should not have done that much damage to their bodies, so that by the time they're ready for a marriage, you know, they can actually show up for their spouse or their loved ones or their girlfriend.
Yeah.
And then the other part about it that became spiritual for me was, I now understood why the Bible then says no to premarital sex. Because initially when you read it, you're thinking, oh, these people are trying to ruin my vibe. But it was most likely because if you do this prior, you might damage yourself for your partner. Whereas it might be better for you and your partner to just grow in sexuality together, right? But I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah. And, you know, honestly, it's not just men.
Yeah.
Women too, right? Mm-hmm. You could have had experiences in the past and the person you're with is not doing it for you. And then you're thinking, oh my God, my ex in the past. So, you know, it goes both ways as well. And so here's my thing. And this is what I personally think. I think that if people can be open-minded, I think that if there's good communication and people can be open-minded, we can navigate things. So the struggle is, somebody has had this experience, all of this history, like we said, right? And then this person, blank slate, not a lot of history. I mean, things have happened in their lives, of course, that inform their sexuality, but not in terms of, you know, the physicality of it. And by openness, what do I mean in a context like that? First of all, you have to understand that the person that you're with may not be like the people that you've been with before, right? You have to understand that. How do we then come to a point where we say, okay, this is my history and this is where you are. How do we start on a level playing field together? So it's not one person lording you over the other person, that this is what I know. And this is what I see very often. The man, because we're talking about men here, the man then goes, this is not how it is. This is not how sex is. I know sex. I've had sex, lots of it. So this is not how it's supposed to be, right? And then the other person is feeling shamed again, right? As if all the shame that we've experienced is not enough. Person is feeling shamed, blamed, inadequate, right? And then there's that friction because now, It's not us against the problem. It's now you against me. It's now I'm okay, you are not, right? And that in itself causes problems. But if we can say, I mean, what has happened. You've had your history. As a matter of fact, just a slight detour, I've seen lots and lots of couples who never had sex outside of marriage, but got into marriage and still had difficulty navigating sex. So one way or the other, there's usually a struggle one way or the other. You may not have, I've had people who have never had sex say, I wish I had sex. Just like you're saying that, because people are saying, I wish I never had sex. But I'm seeing people who never did as a couple, and they're saying, I wish I did. I've seen couples, many, who never had any experience, have been married for years and never been able to achieve penetration. Yes, I've seen 6 years, I've seen 4 years, I've seen 10 years. And they've never been able to achieve penetration. So you understand that struggle can exist. So regardless of where people are coming from, sexual struggles can exist, right? And so if we understand that, and understand that sex is not just about what happens on the bed, but also what happens before we get to the bed. Mm. How do we start to communicate? How can I be open enough to say, yes, I've had experiences, but I want to look at you differently. I want to come to you as if I haven't had any experience with you because I haven't. And then I want to learn you and I want you to learn me. Now that's a better place. That's a better, a level playing field to start from, as opposed to carrying all that baggage and saying, hey, I know this thing. I know how it goes, right? Because, you know, very interestingly, we talk about, so even in the place of pleasure, we say, oh, if you know, women, a lot of women like their breasts being stimulated and stuff. There are some women that do not like it.
Yeah.
And it's not about trauma. Mm. They just don't really enjoy sensations. Just as a man's body can be different from the next man, a woman's body can be different from the next woman. So how do I come to you and say, hey, I'm coming to you open-minded and I'm saying to you, I want to know you sexually. I want to please you sexually. I want to experience you sexually because I realize that this is a unique experience for me and it's not about what I've done in the past. So I think that if people can be open-minded enough, I mean, there's, I mean, it's okay to have the past that you have, but don't lord it over the other person and don't bring it into the experience or into your relationship and say, this is how it must be. Can we be open-minded enough to realize that it can be different with this other person? And how can I learn this person that I'm with?
Yeah, it's just also making sure your ego doesn't show up as well,
absolutely,
right? Because there's the ego that's saying,
yeah,
okay, you know they do, I'm like this now. Like, what's going on?
Yeah.
Okay. You've worked with men across different income and status levels. What's the emotional pain you see hiding underneath hypersexuality?
So, for a lot of people, rejection, either at a young age or even as an adult in their marriages, I think we expect men to be so sexually forward and sexually aggressive that we don't really factor in the emotional side of sex and sexuality, even for men. A lot of men experience a lot of pain in the place of rejection, especially when they're rejected by their partners, right? So from a woman, she can think, I'm not in the mood, I don't feel like, and it's okay to not be in the mood, right? But there are better ways to communicate these things. But if a man is trying to express that need, again, sex means different things to different people. And so if for a person, it means this is my way of connecting with you, just like women say, I want to connect with you emotionally, I want to spend quality time with you, I want to do all. For a man, that could be his own way of expressing love. This is my way of connecting with you. I want us to connect together sexually. This is my way of showing love. This is my understanding of what love, one of the ways love can be. And so when I come to you and I want to be sexual with you and you turn me down, I'm feeling rejected, not just you rejecting the advance that I have made, but I feel like there's also a rejection of self. And I think that a lot of people don't realize how deeply that hurts. There's a lot of pain. There was this couple I worked with, and in this session, the man was close to tears. He was close to tears. Like, I've done everything you can think of for this woman. I even take care of the kids so that she has time to, you know, he had done a lot. And she admitted that he had done a lot. But things were not just happening in the bedroom. And you could see the pain. It was like, even though I wasn't the one, but I could feel his pain. It was that serious. I had to reach out a couple of sessions later just to see how they were doing and stuff like that. But I think that's something that is very grossly underestimated, because we think that men are just about the physical. But rejection can be a really deep emotional one for a lot of men.
I don't think this is a particular issue or challenge in Nigeria. I think this is even wider in the Black diaspora. Yeah, it's a global thing, but you know, I'm here and it's what I've seen. So I also feel like a lot of men are like hypersexualized, right? There's constantly this conversation around, and many women who say, just know your man's going to cheat, you know, just it is what it is, right? And it's kind of with this notion of, you know, one or two things. Either A, at some point, there's a notion that women, once they have children, they just don't want to have sex anymore. And so they've kind of said, well, if my man wants to go outside, as long as he takes care of the home, it's fine, right?
Yeah.
And then there's kind of this other thing of, you know, this man's libido is so much that he needs, you know, and he'll even say, well, men are supposed to hunt. You know, men are supposed to always be on the prowl. Yes, I'm married, but I still need my needs mm-hmm. met. But so why is that the case? Or is it just this, it's a myth?
Mm. Okay. So I think, let me put it this way. Society has given us that expectation or that understanding that men are very hypersexual. Yeah. And to some extent, it may be true. And perhaps on an individual basis, this can differ. But I've also seen in the course of my work that it's not a general rule. Mm. Not all men are like that. I have a good number of men. There are a good number of marriages now where the woman is the one with a much higher libido than the man. Yeah, absolutely. So I've seen a lot of men who are not hypersexual, are not as sexually forward as you would think or expect men to be. And guess what? Even in that space, they're shamed. Because you think, this is how a man is supposed to be. So if I walk past you, you should be instantly aroused. And then if he doesn't do that, you're thinking, is something wrong with me? It starts with that. And then later, is something wrong with you? Because you're not reacting in this way. But not every man is like that. Your libido, our libidos, generally, both men and women can exist in different ways. So for instance, there's what we call the spontaneous libido, and then there's what we call the responsive libido. Now, the spontaneous one is the one where somebody, you know, spontaneously wants sex. But the responsive one is where something has to generate that desire. Mm-hmm. So the spontaneous one, desire is spontaneously generated. You can just be sitting down and somebody passes and you're like, oh my God, mm-hmm. right? But in the responsive case, it's not so much. There has to be an arousal stimulus that generates the desire. So I like to say the desire is taking a nap in the responsive case, but the arousal stimulus has to wake it up. And most times we think it's women that have, first of all, responsive desire is misunderstood. Most people who have responsive desire don't know and they think they have a low libido, but that's another conversation. So we think a lot of women are responsive. Yeah. So women would watch a nice movie, intimating, and they're like, oh, okay, all right, okay, not bad. I think I'd like to. But we don't really understand that men can also be like that. It's not about gender. Men can also have what we call responsive sexual desire, where sex is not on the forefront of their minds. But when maybe you start to touch them, they start to become interested in it, right? So not all men are hypersexual, right? And I also don't believe that all men cheat.
Okay, let's go there.
I don't, right? Mm. Because we have to understand, again, coming to everybody has history, right? We have to understand where people are coming from, yeah? If people are coming from a place where they have, you know, been taught or they've seen the right things modeled to them, for instance. You are a child brought up in a marriage where you see your mom and your dad is devoted to your mom and things like that. You're not likely going to grow up and then say you're just going to be a cheat, except there's something that comes in your development that just, you know. But there are men who are responsible. There are men who have decided to be sexually faithful. There are men, I've seen a lot of men whose wives have cheated and they say, I'm not going to do the same. I'm going to stay in this marriage and we're going to work it out. They exist. Mm. We see them. But the stories are not as rampant as what we hear of when we talk about, oh, men cheating and stuff like that. But we see them all the time. Not all men cheat. And it's not just about the woman. Some men have chosen to be faithful to their vows because they take those things seriously, right? And so it's not even about, I don't want to hurt you. It's about, this is my principle as a human being. And just for the way we think a lot of men cheat and we think women don't really, there are women that cheat, right? And so it comes down to the individual. And I do not honestly think that men cheat. So I will tell people this. You want to control what you expose yourself to. So if every day you're exposing yourself to stories of people who cheat, people around you cheating, you think that's the way of the world. That's your worldview. right? But if you're exposed to something, even if you're exposed to, even if what has been modeled to you is infidelity, and then you choose to expose yourself to a different kind of information, faithfulness, fidelity, you are actually going out there to look for people who are not cheating, marriages that are where the couples are faithful to each other. You can't change what you focus on, and you can control your exposure. So I don't think that all men cheat. And interestingly, it can be a self-fulfilling prophecy where you think, oh, all men cheat anyway. So even if I don't give it to him, even if we don't have sex, even if I focus on the kids, well, he's going to do what he's going to do anyway. And then you do what you're going to do. Do you understand? So when I had my first child, when I was pregnant, when we were pregnant, one of the things I told myself was, I'm not going to put any child above my husband. They will know that I love them. They will know that we love them. But I'm not going to put any child above my husband. And we're pregnant at the time. And then that was my commitment to myself and to our marriage and to my husband. But the actions were not up to me alone. My husband and I had a conversation around that. And my husband, when we had our first child, my husband was and still is the most hands-on father. So I would sleep. He would tell me, just go and sleep. I'll take care of the baby. So his actions allowed me to stay and be able to be faithful to the commitment that I made. So imagine if he did not. It would have been difficult. But he was a support. I don't like to say support because I feel both of us are in this together. Both of us are the parents of the child. So he was there. He would take care of the child. I would get rest. I would get sleep. He'd say, you know what? Go and do whatever you want to do. I will stay back. I will do this. He was there. And now our children grew up in a home where they see their dad cater to their mom, where they see their dad serve their... There's some things I don't like to say on. But basically, they see their dad. So I have a 7 and a 10-year-old. And then one day, I just asked them separately. And I said, what do you see when you look at me and daddy? And I'm not saying we have a perfect marriage or anything by any means. And they said, I see respect. Mm. And then I see love. Mm. I see how daddy takes care of you. And I see how you take care of him. And I see how both of you sometimes will just go to a hotel and grandma takes care of us. Because we do that.
Yeah.
And what they're learning is these people prioritize themselves as a couple. And they're seeing that. We're modeling something to them. And they're learning. Because in everything that we do, our children are seeing what we do in any case, even when we think we're not, they're not. But they are seeing that. Mm-hmm. And so my point is sometimes it can be a self-fulfilling prophecy if you think that this person is going to do this anyway, and then you don't even bother with the things that you're supposed to do.
Mm. You've said Lagos is full of intimacy dysfunction.
Not just Lagos.
Not just Lagos, for sure.
It's everywhere.
Globally at this point. What are the most common intimacy issues you're seeing between couples today?
Desire discrepancy. When one person has a higher libido than the other person, that's one of the very, very extremely common ones.
Is it a libido thing or is it more of trauma?
Well, not so much trauma, but just the fact that one person wants more sex than the other person. Mm. Now, if we probe underneath, there can be so many different things that have caused that to happen, where, again, there could be trauma. Like you said, one person could be dealing with trauma that they've experienced in their life, sexual or otherwise. That has caused them to not express sexually or has caused them to hate sex, right? And then on the other hand, it might not be. It just might be life issues. You go to work, I'm stressed, I'm tired. Oh my God, sex is the last thing on my mind. I just want to sleep. There's that as well, right? So it could be a whole lot of, a myriad of different factors. But that's like the most prevalent issue when it comes to couples, desire discrepancy. One person wants to have. I've seen couples where they live in the same house. Mm. I'm not even saying long distance. I've seen couples where they live in the same house. There's no problem in terms of sexual pain or vaginismus or anything like that. In terms of genital function, everybody's functioning fine. But they've not had sex in 2 years, in five years, but they live in the same house.
Mm.
So there are a lot of issues like that.
Mm. Can you go deeper? So if a couple hasn't had sex in 5 years, is there a specific pattern? Is it literally like, this person just doesn't want to have sex. And that's that.
Yeah, it could be one person. Usually it's one person, right? One person not wanting to have sex. More often than not, it's usually one person and the other person wants, right? Mm. And then because the other person, of course, you can't force the other person to do what they don't want to do. They've tried, they've argued, they've talked, they've done all sorts of things. But things are not just working out. And the other person insists, I don't want to have sex. At some point, you even see situations where the person who doesn't want to have sex is, oh yeah, just come and do what you want to do. And then the other person feels, no, that seems like I'm raping you. And so that's not going to happen. Because people are looking for energy that is on the same wavelength. So the passion that I have is the passion that you're giving. Right? I'm giving and receiving. I'm receiving that same kind of intensity from you as well. And that is what is exciting for people. That being reciprocated, not one person, you know, showing all of that and the other person just saying, okay, yeah, that's what you want to do and let's get out of this space. And so when that is not happening, even if people are having sex and it's high, low kind of equation or dynamic going on, it's not satisfying. It's not fulfilling. And you get to a point where people will say, I'd rather not even have the sex in the first place, right? But when that passion intensity goes both ways, it can be really exciting, which is why when people, you know, cheat, for instance, the novelty of meeting somebody new can be very interesting.
Yeah.
And there's so much intensity. And that experience is a high. It's interesting. It's good that people want more of that. So if that is not even happening in the relationship, that itself in itself can be a problem. But when things like that happen, we want to understand why is there a discrepancy in how both of you are even presenting to each other. For some people, it's just a discomfort with expressing sexually. For some people, they don't even know what to do in the bedroom. And there's room for learning, right? For some people, it's he wants it. Let him have it. I don't have to be actively, you know, be an active participant. You know, so there's so many different things. For some people, it's a level of skill, you know, all of those things. So many factors could lead to that.
So you've expressed in the past sexual abuse that you've been a victim of it. I want you to talk about how that experience has shaped your worldview. And even if you bring it into your practice? Is it a way you're able to connect with people that come in and speak about it?
Yeah. So, yes, I was raped at 15 when thieves came to our house. And that happened anyway. So, for me, very interesting. You know, I told you that I've always been interested in sex.
Yeah.
I've always been interested in the concept, the science of it and all of that. So even though nobody specifically told me about sex, I already had a positive view about sex. And also, I must attribute this to my mom as well. She didn't speak to me about sex. But my mom was very open about relationships. Yeah. And so my first boyfriend was also at 15. And she said, I know you are dating him. I don't want you to do corner anything. Bring him to the house. I was 15, he was 18, right? And so I would bring him to the house. He would visit. He would see my mom, my siblings, my grandma. Like, he would sit down and just be gisting with everybody. And then they would allow me to visit him as well. So it was open. We did it for 3 years and we never had sex. Because it was as if they made us responsible for ourselves. They trusted us. They gave us that trust and we did not want to break it. And so relationships are very close to sex, even though she didn't speak to me about sex. So those things really helped me to have a very positive view about sex. Now, when I was raped, this was some of the things that helped me. I could differentiate between sex and it wasn't sex that was the problem. Most people who experience sexual abuse or are raped go on to maybe hate sex or go on the other end of the spectrum and it's compulsive behavior and what have you. But for me, it wasn't sex that was the problem. It was the people and how they chose to use it. Because sex can be used so amazingly, so beautifully, right? But at the same time, it can be abused. It's not sex that is the problem. It's the people and how they used it. And so that for me was one of the reasons why it did not affect how I saw sex for me, sexually. That the rape did not affect how I saw. It affected a couple of other things. I wouldn't be able to wind down the car when I go out. I would feel very exposed. I would have to check the door several times. I wouldn't be able to open the windows when I'm sleeping and all of that. But when it came to sex, and that's the interesting thing about trauma, it can splash in so many ways, right? But when it came to sex, it was not, I had that positive view about sex that for me, I knew it wasn't about sex and sex wasn't the problem. It was the people and the way they used it. And when I work with clients, I share some of those things with them. But of course, everybody's journey is different.
Yeah.
Where everybody's coming from is different. The way I healed might have not been the way that they healed. And my healing happened in stages. So that was one part of it. But the fact that I wasn't allowed to speak was also trauma for me.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened was, I was 15, so I'd never had sex. So when that happened, and it was four of them that raped me, so they took turns. And so my dad took me to the hospital the next day. And the doctor, they sedated me and did stuff. So after when I came around, the doctor said, don't tell anybody that you've been raped. You know, so basically they had stitched the hymen back. And so if I didn't tell anybody and the next person I had, and the first person I chose to have consensual sex with had sex with me, he would have thought I was a virgin. Do you understand? So they had stitched the hymen back and said, you don't have to tell anybody and stuff like that. So everybody around me was just like, you don't have to tell anybody. You don't have to tell anybody. You don't have to talk. So I couldn't talk about it. And I was hurting. So the sex part, I was good, but I couldn't express. And so the trauma was just there, preserved for years. You know, I couldn't do a lot of things. Even when I wouldn't just go to anybody's house because I would think maybe the day I come to your house, that things will come to your house. So I'm not going, you know, and stuff like that, right? But eventually, I did start to explore therapy. And then for the first time, I was able to talk about it. I was like, oh, my God. And I wasn't shushed. I wasn't told, no, it's something shameful. Don't talk about it. It will stain you. I was allowed to express myself. So that's one of the things that I do even with my clients. I allow you to express however it is that you feel, whatever emotions that you feel and all of that. And, you know, as much as that trauma has happened, we want to understand, where are you looking at? Where do you want to go? What is the goal for you? And our therapy usually would focus on, while still taking account of everything that you feel and everything that you are processing, our intervention starts to focus mainly on where you want to go.
Hmm. You know, my question around this is, you know, it seems like your parents were involved, and I'm not sure, so I would like to understand that, but I think the other layer is, you know, if a child experiences that, how do parents manage that? Because I also feel, I'll never forget, there was a thread on Twitter and, you know, a man came out and said, you know, for the first time, I'm publicly saying I was sexually abused as a child. And this is a space for other men to talk about it, right? And I mean, what is it like? Thousands of men responded to this thing. And what was strange, you know, and I think there's a whole other thing to unpack, was most of them said they were abused by someone they knew. It was an aunt. It was a cousin. It was a nanny, you know, and they had to hide it, you know, and many of them still have not dealt with it. Mm-hmm. So what do you say about like how parents can? Yeah.
Yeah. So having worked with a lot of people who experience sexual abuse, just like you said, a lot of them don't say it to anybody. And I ask them a lot. I say, why do you think you didn't say it to anybody? Why do you think? So you've had people who have been sexually, but they didn't tell even their parents.
Mm.
That's if it wasn't one of the parents that did it, right? Maybe a house help or cousin or somebody. Most of them, at least 99% of the people who I've worked with who experienced sexual trauma as children, so childhood sexual abuse, they didn't tell their parents. And for me, that speaks to the whole taboo thing and also an environment of safety, emotional safety as a family as well. Not being able to see your parent as a place where you can be emotionally safe. That's one. And I'm coming back there. But the second part, very interestingly, is that some of them didn't even realize what was being done. They just knew that somebody was touching them, but they knew it felt wrong. but they didn't realize what was being done. And that's why we say sexuality education for children is important. Because if there was that awareness, they would have known that this is exactly what this person is doing to me, and it's wrong. And they would have either tried to stop it or told a parent, because at that time, they had the understanding of what was happening. So you see a lot of people who didn't even really understand. Well, they were just confused. At the time, it was, he would put his hand in my panties and then I'm just looking. I didn't understand it. I didn't understand. Or he would tell me to open up, or she would do this, she would do that. But I didn't understand what was going on. And that's why we say sexuality education for children is absolutely important. And coming back to the parent and a place of safety, that's another thing. So even in cases where the people understood what was going on, they knew that something was wrong, a lot of people would not have shared with their parents. And I asked them why. A lot of people, they would say, I think they would have beaten me. Or I think that they would have blamed me. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, a few of them did not open up, but later the parents found out. And what happened? Blame. Shame. Why didn't you say anything? How could you let that happen? So it was not about them. Now they were blaming them.
Mm.
Right? And so the role of parents, whether or not, you know, that has happened to the child, is to be a place of safety and to be a place that your child can come to anytime they face anything at all. Mm. And so I tell my children all the time, it's my job to protect you. Allow me to do my job. It doesn't matter anybody's bullying you in school, anything at all, whatever it is, allow me to do my job. Just know that I always have your back and you can come to me. So that place of safety is very important. That parents be that place of safety and hold space for these children. It's not about blaming them. Even if they understood what was going on, even if they knew what was going on, you have to still be that place of safety.
Mm.
And possibly also take them to therapy, you know. Help them through it. Help them understand it wasn't their fault. Help them understand they're not damaged and anything like that. That helps. Trauma is a negative experience, but people can heal from trauma. And the earlier it happens, the better. So if parents, you know, stop closing their eyes to sex or to sexuality, as the case may be, and, you know, start to function in that space of safety for their children know that, if I go to my parents, I will get the right answers. If I go to my parents, I will get the right support. If I go to my parents, I will be safe. They need to help.
I think there's a book called, I think, The Body Keeps Score.
Yes.
Mm.
And for a lot of people who've been through sexual trauma and sexual abuse, there's always the trauma bonding that happens. Maybe you now start to trauma bond with other people who've been through similar things, right? And I guess the conversation and the question I have is, how does one begin to reclaim their body, their voice, and their story as well? How does that process go?
Yeah. And so the process of reclaiming their bodies and their stories is, you know, for a lot of people who have been sexually abused, one of the things that happens is a loss of control over their bodies, which is why you would find that even though an individual has been sexually abused once, it can happen again and again and again, because for them, it's just a loss of control. This thing is not my own. It's what people use. Mm. And I no longer have control or autonomy over my own body, right? And that dissociation starts to happen. So one of the things that we do in therapy, I would always recommend therapy for that. One of the things that we do in therapy is initiating, bringing back that control over your body, right? Helping the clients to own their bodies safely through, of course, therapeutic interventions and also through somatic interventions as well that have to do with, you know, actually experiencing your body. So I tend to use both, you know, the psychotherapy and also somatic interventions and practices where you're actually having physical practices that can help you start to own your body physically as well and bring you back into your body. Because what happens with a lot of people who experience sexual trauma is also, even during the process and perhaps even subsequent processes, if that happens over and over again, is there's what we call this out-of-body experience. So it's almost like you've gone out of your body and you're just looking down on what has happened to you. So coming back into your body, both through therapeutic approaches and also somatic approaches, can also be very helpful to them. And also dispelling shame. It wasn't your fault. The fact that you didn't even put up a fight wasn't your fault. Perhaps that was even a survival strategy for you, right? So there's no shame there in what was done to you. And there's no need for you to carry the shame of what has been done to you through no fault of yours, right? And so helping people to understand that and work through that really helps. It's a journey. And I have to say this. Most people think you come into therapy and the journey just like, it can be like this, right? Times is up and down, this cyclical, I mean, but it's a journey eventually. And don't be hard on yourself. Give yourself space and room to heal and time to heal.
What advice would you have for partners of people who've been through sexual trauma, right? Because I think so many times the initial reaction is, I'm feeling rejected.
Yes.
They don't want me to touch them, or maybe you prefer these other people's touches versus mine.
Yeah.
What advice would you have for them to be able to navigate, you know, the being with a partner who's been sexually abused or sexually traumatized?
The first thing I would say is, please don't ever say to anybody, it happened a long time ago, you should be over it. Don't ever say that to anybody. Mm. Because trauma is so interesting that, especially if it hasn't been processed, it just stays there, right? And it can be, when people are put in states where they have to relieve that, it's as fresh as if it happened yesterday or it's happening right now.
Yeah.
So there's no statute of limitation on that, right? And so saying to a person, it happened long ago, you should have gotten over it, is the worst thing you can say to anybody who has been through trauma. So I usually would tell people, please don't say that. If you haven't been through trauma, you cannot really understand what someone who has been through trauma has been through. So don't attempt to
minimize.
Exactly, right? To be in their space of mind and say, okay, but try now, just try. I've had situations whereby lots of couples, and maybe there's an issue where they say, phobia for sex, intercourse specifically, and then the person is tensing up and tightening up and every, and this is not even vaginismus, you know, I'm saying trauma related phobia for sex now, so the person tightens up and tenses up, and then penetration becomes absolutely almost impossible and intensely painful and all of that, and then somebody says, just try manage. In fact, there was someone who said to me in session, I said, hey, but there's a thin line between pleasure and pain now. Should you be able to chest it?
Yeah. Hey. So I should just be having painful sex, okay.
So that's important, you know. You can show empathy as well. It's important to show empathy for the journey that they're on. And, you know, in the space of reclaiming their bodies, it's very important for them to know that there is control. So you can't force anything because you are further traumatizing them. You can't force anything. You have to come from a cooperative angle. If possible, go to therapy with them if they want you to be there, or if the therapist requires you to be there for some sessions, please be there and be there fully for them. Hold space for them, right? And, you know, just walk through that journey with them. But don't use your untraumatized state of mind or eye to look at someone who's been through trauma and say, oh, this is how it's supposed to be.
Mm. I want to also speak on, and the Diddy trial is happening right now, right? And again, allegedly, to cover this conversation.
Say allegedly.
That's why I say allegedly, to cover this conversation. But I think coming up, a lot of my peers, there was this whole debate about what sort of life track do some of us want to have? Do we want to be single, live the life like Diddy, parties, women, and you sleep with whoever you want? Or do we want to maybe go like other men and get married and settle down, right? I want to talk more about what role does discipline play in this whole hypersexual like lifestyle? Because for looking back now, you're saying to yourself, well, at some point, the guardrails that should have been there for Diddy allegedly got like skipped. Like he went past the the Rubicon, right? He's crossed it, right? And to the point where there are men who are also hypersexual who are like, yo, you definitely need to relax, right? And what is the role of discipline mean for men, especially because on one side, they've learned to be hunters, conquer, go after what you want. And there's that feeling, that primal instinct feeling that you love it. But then on the other hand, it's the denying of yourself of displeasure can also lead to discipline that keeps you out of potentially appearing on a video camera where you're doing crazy things, right? So you've seen the same thing with men like maybe Shannon Sharp or Diddy. What role does that self-discipline or sexual discipline play for men?
It plays an important role. Discipline, sexual discipline for anybody, as a matter of fact, is something that a lot of people must have, because whether we like it or not, the sexual urge is so powerful. It's so powerful that if you don't take a stand for something, you will fall for everything. And so discipline, having values that you want to live by as a person, is extremely important for you to be able to navigate that. And again, coming to hypersexuality, sometimes there's nothing wrong with sexually expressing yourself. I think it's an amazing thing, right? But when or if you know that this need for sex is driven by something else, you want to address that.
Yeah.
Right? If it's about acceptance, for instance, people want to feel accepted and they what's it called? Substitute sex for acceptance. So I want to feel accepted. If you have sex with me, the fact that you're close to me, it means I feel accepted and what have you. Whatever it is that is driving, if you know and you can objectively and truthfully, honestly tell yourself that there is something that is driving this, then it means you're no longer in control. It means you're no longer in control, and then you have to address whatever is driving that behavior. But in the space of even just expressing sexually, healthily, and all of that, I think that discipline plays a huge role, not even in the space that we are now in terms of a lot of STIs going on, not even just the whole media and all of that hula baloo that is happening, but even for your own health as an individual, there's so many risks if you are not circumspect sexually. And so I think that discipline plays a very important role. And I do think that if you don't have sex, you don't die. It's true.
Yeah.
So when people say it's a basic instinct, I debate it. Right? So when we say, oh, sex is a basic instinct like hunger, thirst, sleep.
Shelter.
I'm saying if you don't eat for a number of days, you will die. If you don't drink water for a number of days, you will die. If you don't have sex, you'll not die. You'll be all right. Right? And I think people have to also understand that it's not the basic drive that they think it is. You can actually, as a matter of fact, there are people who can actually rechannel that energy into something else. And I'm not even just talking single people. I'm not talking even married people. Your spouse might not be around you and stuff like that. But your honey, you can say, hey, I see you. I know you're here. But you can rechannel. I'm not saying ignore it. I'm not saying suppress it. I'm saying you can rechannel it. And under the appropriate circumstances for you, you express it. But I do think that people have to understand that the sex drive is not that, is a powerful drive, but it's not the basic drive they think it is. If you don't have sex, you're not going to die.
What do men say to you in therapy that they don't say anywhere else?
So a lot of reasons why I get men in therapy, addictions, and very, very often if there's an issue with their erection. So I make this joke that most women want to come and learn, but most men are not necessarily interested in learning. They want to resolve an issue. Then if something wrong with the direction, they will be chasing me up and down. Please welcome. Men don't play with their erections at all.
They're like, what is the reason?
What's going on? Because they think it's like their manhood.
Yeah, like, it is so if I can't stand it up to their essence and their egos. That if something is wrong with the erection, the men are like, my God, what?
My village people.
Anything, right? And that space, very interesting. I've seen a lot of men come in to say, I can't get it up with my wife, or I can't sustain it with my wife. When I go outside, I'm able to. So, of course, many of them haven't told their wives that they've tried it elsewhere. So they come and they say, I'm not able to achieve or sustain, but when I go outside, I'm able to, maybe I'm not attracted to my wife again. I hear that a lot. And here's the thing. It's not necessarily so, because there's a mechanism behind it. So when a man loses his erection, that happens here and there. It's not a big deal when it happens, you know, occasionally. It's not a big deal. It happens to a lot of people, right? But when it becomes so, if that happens, right, and the man starts to get anxious, and it happens with the wife, right, and he starts to get anxious, what's going on? And then maybe next time they try again because he's anxious now. It happens again. It's like, what's going on? The wife too is like, what's going on? So now there's anxiety. Yeah. Anytime it can be such a vicious cycle that anytime he approaches the wife for sex, because his mind is, hey, am I going to achieve it again? Am I going to disappoint this woman? Is he going to go down? Is he going to stand up? He's spectatoring essentially, right? He's no longer in his body, he's now in his head. And the body is so beautifully and wonderfully designed in a way that if your the arousal process is different from anxiety process, right? So if your brain picks up on that anxiety,
shuts down.
It's going to shut down the arousal process. Because what happens when you're anxious? Your body goes into fight, flight, or freeze, right? And the blood goes into your muscles. It doesn't matter whether it's perceived anxiety or real anxiety. The way, just so imagine this, if you have your favorite food in front of you, you start to salivate. If you are thinking of it, it's not in front of you, you start to salivate. Your brain has taken that mental, so you've supplied the, do you understand? So it doesn't matter if it's real anxiety or perceived anxiety in your head, your brain will react the same way. It has picked up on anxiety. And what happens? When you want to fight or you want to run away, you want to freeze, you don't need an erection, right? So it will take blood. And move it to the muscles, and so this person has to run, or he has to fight, or he has to freeze. So you don't need an erection to do. Why would you be fighting with an erection? So that does. So every time he approaches the woman, right? That happens. He loses the erection because now it's a cycle. And performance anxiety has set in, and it has become this vicious cycle. Now, and I've had a lot of men say this to me. I'm not saying all doctors say it, but I've had quite a number of men say this to me, that they've gone to doctor and doctor say, everything, they've tested, everything is fine with you. Maybe you should try it on another woman. Mm-hmm. I don't know why some doctors would say that. I think it's very unscrupulous and unethical. And so on the advice, because this is an authority, they will go and try it. Now, with a new person, there's novelty. There's some sort of excitement. There's some, you understand? So that overrides, do you understand? And you're able to achieve the reaction. You're like, it must be my wife. Something was, maybe I'm not sexually attracted to her. But that is not it. If we can, performance anxiety is the culprit here. We deal with performance anxiety, you and your wife are fine.
Yeah.
So that's one of the issues.
How can men begin to rebuild intimacy with themselves, not just their partners?
Yeah. Okay. That's a very good question. I like it. And so what is intimacy? Intimacy. So that means seeing yourself and honoring the journey that you have been on in your life. Like we said, however it is you've come up, this is how, if any other person walked in your shoes, they probably will be where you are today. So you have to honor the process. You have to honor that journey and where you are today. Accept it. It doesn't matter if you've made mistakes or whatever it is. Aside shaming yourself, instead of shaming yourself or feeling guilt, accept the journey that you've been on. And then you can then say to yourself, who do I want to be? I see that this is where I'm coming from. I see that this is how I got here. But who do I really want to be? And what are the things I want to start doing with myself, right? And then people start to nurture their minds, their bodies, their faith, their spirituality, or their spirit, as the case may be, right? And I think that that's a very important way people can start to build intimacy with themselves, honoring the process, honoring their journeys, not with shame or guilt, but just honoring that process and accepting themselves and then saying, okay, what do I want to see in my life? Where do I want to go? Where do I want to be? And taking the steps, you know, to take them there.
So we're going to get to the rapid fired questions, right? Okay. So just think, pop, it's like popcorn on your feet. So, and I love this question, right? I'm helping all the women out there. What's the one thing men should stop doing immediately in bed? Like something you always see men do, and you know women don't like it.
Okay. Don't assume that you know what she wants or what she likes. allow her to tell you what she wants and what she likes. It's rapid fire, so I can't say too much.
Okay. So what is the most overrated sex tip you've heard?
What is the most overrated sex tip I've heard? I can't think of any at the moment. I think because these things are very individual. So I would have said spontaneous sex is better than planned sex. That's what I would have said. But you have people who say, oh, I love planned sex. But I think that, sorry, so you have a lot of people who are over-indexing on it has to be spontaneous, passionate, and all of that. If it's not, that means the magic is gone. I don't think it's true. I think you have to understand that sex is a part of your life. And sex is not in a bubble, right? Everything that happens in your life influences even your sex life and all of that. So make space. As a matter of fact, planning it can even be more anticipation building. It can be more erotic, you know. It can be, you can put the things you want to see in that process as opposed to the one bam, thank you, ma'am. Spontaneous is good in its own right. But I think that planned sex is also great. So I don't think that if you're not having spontaneous sex, then something is wrong.
Wait, actually, I want to ask another question on that because lately, and I don't know, maybe because now I'm married, so I've been seeing a lot of like conversations around this and even, you know, other therapists even saying you should plan it, right? Like if you want sex in your life, you want a, you know, a marriage full of it, you should be planning it. Yeah. So how can it be planned in a way that doesn't feel like, okay, on Tuesday at 8 p.m.,
this is going to go down.
We going down.
So here's the thing. Okay. I also want to, let me add this.
Okay.
You can have two individuals in a marriage with entirely different personalities, right? The person who is a sanguine, for instance, would really gravitate towards spontaneous things, right? The person who perhaps is melancholic likes order in their life.
Yeah.
Right. And that usually is the challenge, right?
Yeah.
And here's what I say. You that you like order in your life, you can plan it. You don't necessarily need to I don't need to tell you who is the sanguine that look, I already have 3 days a week on my calendar. You understand? I can plan it and know that there's order in my life and in my mind. I don't have to tell you, but I will come to you and you will receive it as spontaneous. But I don't have to tell you. Do you understand? And so that helps couples deal with all the one person wants planned. Do you understand? But in terms of even planning it as a couple, you can make it fun. You can make it fun. So I wrote a book, Sexcapades.
Yes.
Yeah, we have.
Yeah. So sometimes just picking a chapter from the book and just reading it together, because it has like erotic prefaces, you know, erotic preludes. You're reading that together and then you're going into it and you're like, oh, okay, let's do this. So sometimes you can just sit in bed together and just decide that, hey, this is what we want to do. Pick up the book. We're doing chapter 20. That's what you can do. Or I also would recommend that people have sex dates. So we're saying plan it, but it doesn't have to be like plan, right? But it can also be a sex date. And I usually would recommend that couples, at the very least once a week, have a sex date that is nothing less than an hour. And I say that, people are like, how are you doing an hour? What are you doing?
This economy.
So what are we doing for an hour?
Right? I go 2 hours, 3 hours, right? Last Saturday was like 2 hours. But that's the point.
Yeah.
The definition that we have of sex is so limited to intercourse that we think that when we're talking about sex, it's just intercourse we're talking about. But there's more. All of your senses, right? There's touch, there's exploration, there's taste, all of that. Like creating a proper feast
experience
for yourselves. Absolutely, right? So I hope it's not TMI.
No.
Last Saturday, one of the things that what we chose to do last Saturday was take turns just exploring each other's bodies. So I would explore his chest, right, for a while, and then he would do mine.
Yeah.
And it was really erotic, and then we'd do the back, and then the butt, and then other areas. It was really fun. And then we're like, that for like 19 minutes before we now actually even, before we even started kissing.
Okay, we need a lesson because people not doing that.
Nigerian men don't have time for that. We have things to do.
You can always learn.
But patience, though, right?
Yeah.
Patience.
I mean, because the way we have defined sex is so narrow. Limited. It's so intercourse focused.
You're right.
As a matter of fact, for some people, they've not had intercourse. They don't feel they've had sex. Mm. But in actual fact, you can go around the entire sexual cycle from pleasure, desire to orgasm, and a penis hasn't even gone inside the vagina.
That's true.
But you have people saying, that's the real thing. Mm. It doesn't happen. But I think that if we're a bit more open-minded...
It's not the funnest thing sometimes.
Yeah.
But sometimes the other stuff...
Yeah.
I mean, and it's okay to have...
Yeah.
That's true.
Intercourse, right? Yeah. There's nothing wrong with it. But if it's so... If your definition of sex is so limited to intercourse, it takes a whole lot of things off the table. You don't even know what your body is capable of. You have no idea.
Love that. So the last question we ask every single guest on the Afropolitan podcast is, who do you want to see in this seat? Whose story do you think needs to be told?
Wow. Blindsided me. Tara Feladurotoy.
I know her. Awesome. That's a good one. Yeah, thank you.
I have
one more question.
This is really for a specific friend of mine, right? The examples, other men go through it. There's this thing where men, maybe as single men, they've developed a habit of having sex, right? Like they're having multiple sexual partners. They're doing that a lot, which is different from the question I had before. What can you say, or what advice can you give to some of those men to, because when they do get into marriage, they think like it's easy as flipping a switch, right? Oh, we're going to now be faithful. Mm-hmm. We're now going to be just one track minded, right? Yeah. And that really is the case. Mm-hmm. What advice would you have for those men, for them to also understand sometimes you're really putting your body through damage, that the bill and the receipt is going to come due at some point, because now you're in a habit stage, right? So what advice or what tools can you give for those men who are looking to navigate that?
Yeah. So first of all, we're creatures of habit.
Yeah.
I do doesn't automatically change you into someone else. So if you're telling yourself, I'm going to get it out of my system, what's going to be left in the marriage? But let me get it out of it. But anyway, we're creatures of habit. Yeah. And it's not just going to switch like that. If you're going to make a change, you want to start making that change early. Not necessarily because of the other person. Not necessarily because of an external motivation. But because you have chosen to do that. And so I will tell them, find your motivation. Why are you saying to yourself you want to change? What is the motivation for you to do that? Because if your motivation is the other person, it's 50-50, right? Find your motivation. And on that journey, you will fall. You likely will. Give yourself grace, you know, and pick yourself up. It doesn't mean that you're a bad person. It doesn't mean that you're doing it wrong. It just means that you're in that process, right? Give yourself grace and keep working towards the goal that you have. But very importantly, let it be a goal that is internally driven, not
externally.
Thank you. Well, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure being here. Thank you.